Once more under the breach, dear friend.
Let's close the wall up with our English did.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting second hour of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure on this Saturday, April 5th of the year 2014. This is the fifth in a row April Fool's Day.
If you insist.
Well, it's April. If you're an April fool, you're going to be a fool all through April, but virtually by definition.
I suppose.
So why not just keep on doing it?
Yeah, it doesn't say April 1st, Fool's Day.
Right, and I think that considering that this is the month in which we typically are due to fill out a very complex form that virtually none of us understand.
Right.
And, you addressing know, laws that nobody completely understands pay an indeterminate amount of money to a government that we don't comprehend.
Right.
It's April Fool's.
Yeah. They're ongoing testing with the tax code. This is done every year by multiple news agencies. There's one agency that's been doing it for 15 plus years, and they take the same information to as many tax preparers as they can, and in a lot of cases it's 15 different tax preparers, major places, minor places, and all of them get signed off on, and none of them have the same results. Any kind of complexity causes them to have different results. Now, if you make $20,000 and that's from one source of income and you're not taking any kind of deductions, you're fine. That's going to be fine. That's going to be the same answer every time, everywhere you go.
Right.
If you have any deductions, if you have any different sources of income, you're going to have something that the IRS can say, this is not how we would have done it.
Well, actually, you can ask the IRS how to do it. They'll tell you how to do it, and then when the agent comes around, he'll say, no, that's not the right way.
Correct. And they say that on the phone,
yes.
By the way. When you call the IRS, they clearly tell you in their recording, anything that we tell you
is not necessarily true.
You need to take the advice of a tax preparer rather than us.
And, of course, we will not necessarily agree with the tax preparer either.
Correct. We won't agree with us, much less anyone else.
Our agency is charged with enforcing the Internal Revenue Code, but we don't understand it, and we can't agree internally on what it means.
And neither can anyone else.
And we're scared of the NSA?
Yeah. The NSA, you know, at least has a clearly defined mission.
You know, the NSA funding comes from the IRS.
It's true.
So could the IRS be using the NSA leaks and Snowden's stuff as a distractor to keep us from noticing what they're doing?
I don't think so, because they don't have to. It's so ubiquitous. We don't even think about it.
But it could be, if you want a conspiracy.
I think the conspiracy, we don't even have to go that far. We can just say the conspiracy has worked so well that we don't even have a second thought about the fact that there are companies that we have our money with who we expect to keep our money completely private. Not due to terrorism or anything else.
Right.
They call the government and tell them exactly what our money positions are. How much money did we make?
They don't call them. They send them messages.
No, they send them electronic messages. They send them pieces of paper.
Well, they've got to.
Exactly.
Because of the Internal Revenue Services. My mother used to call them.
Yes, the Internal Revenue Code says that they've got to do it. And if they don't, then they're going to be in huge trouble.
That's right. And my mother, God bless her departed soul, used to say that there were two terrorist organizations in the world with similar names.
IRA and the IRS?
Yeah, the IRA in Ireland and the IRS in the United States. She owned a small business for many years and was audited on many occasions. Not many occasions, but she was audited on several occasions. And I don't think she ever intentionally cheated on her taxes in her life, but I also think that she probably failed to report things.
I have to come back here and say that, having said all of that about the difficulty of our tax code and how the IRS can't agree on anything, it's not the fault of the IRS. The IRS is doing their job, and without the IRS, we wouldn't have roads,
right.
We
wouldn't have anything.
National defense, we wouldn't have the fact that people are getting Social Security income, all that stuff. The problem is that Congress needs to get their act together and write something that even the people that collect mm-hmm. the taxes can understand. Because we're still seeing the aftershocks of the late budget last year. People have had to wait to the last minute or file an extension for their taxes because the companies that send 1099s out to people, if they've got stocks or bonds or any of that stuff, had to delay because they didn't know what they needed to fill out because Congress passed their budget so late, and the IRS had to then get on the ball really quickly and get out the guidance for the companies. And what it amounted to is that forms that generally go out at the beginning of January wound up going out at the end of March. And people are supposed to file in February 15th, and they've got all of the forms coming in days beforehand. And as is usual, every time they pass a new piece of tax law, it is just the full employment act for all CPAs.
Yep. There's some good news on a different subject. Couple of pieces of good news out there. Well, one piece of good news, one piece of interesting news. Those of you who follow such things in the economy and so on realize that we had a March jobs report.
Yes.
Posted by the bureaucrats at the Bureau of Labor Statistics. By definition, anyone who works there, just like the Bureau of Economic Analysis.
Right. If you work at a bureau, you're a bureaucrat.
They're the honest-to-God bureaucrats. And actually, I've come to like bureaucrats. When they're in the organizations that aren't bureaus, they're less effective. But the ones that are actually in the bureaus produce some good stuff. Anyway, we wound up with about 192,000 new jobs, according to the institutional survey. We wound up with about 475,000 more people working than last month in the household survey. Now, you didn't hear...
How many people?
475,000 more people employed this month.
That's a lot.
In March than in February. And the funny thing is the economists and so on don't even blink an eye at the fact that the institutional survey said 192,000 new jobs. When the Bureau of Labor Statistics calls around to households around the United States and they do a very meaningful survey, very carefully done, it's not like they've never done this before, they discovered that there are 475,000 more people working in March than in February. And they don't even blink an eye at that.
Why would they blink an eye?
I mean, it's that's pretty wild. Anyway, now this is the interesting, and of course, at the same time, the Labor Department revised January and February's job gains, because they've got more detailed information now, up by 37,000. So 144,000 positions in January from the 129, and February was up to 197, sounds familiar, from 175,000. And if you recall, the last several months, every time these things have come out, if they were a little below or something, it was, oh my God, we're slipping back into recession. Folks, it's very, very stable. We're creating in the institutional survey, an institutional survey, by the way, is looking at larger companies that do formal reporting and everything else, that we're up just under 200,000 jobs a month in our economy. Now, there's a very interesting little number that popped up this month in that we finally passed the number of total people employed in the institutional survey, the number of total jobs with people in them who are making money and paying taxes and so on. In the institutional survey, we're now higher than we were in 2008 for the first time. So in a sense, we're recovered. In another sense, though, we've been adding about 144,000 new workers per month on average to the economy for all of those years since 2008. So what we have now is 6 years times 12 months times 144,000. We only have a couple of million people who otherwise would be employed who aren't employed, but which pretty well, by the way, matches up with the unemployment numbers. All these numbers come in together. Then we turn around and look at the household survey, and there's 475,000 more people employed. I don't know what they're doing, but the institutions aren't reporting them. What does all this mean to you, though? It means that our economy is recovering. Is it recovering really, really fast? No. Do we want it to recover really, really fast? Well, some people do, but the fact is the reason that we have had a recovery that has lasted since 2009, we're coming up on 5 years into an economic recovery, 5 years into a bull market, is that the recovery has been so darn slow. Slow recoveries last a lot longer than fast recoveries. Duh. The good news is slow recoveries produce longer bull markets than fast recoveries because we don't wind up with a lot of excess. So believe it or not, all of those numbers I just said, when you put them all together for a long period of time, say we're doing very nicely. And there's one other thing I wanted to throw in here. There's a very significant shift in employment that is good, that is was documented. It's documented in Barron's this week, and it is you can go to the Bureau of Labor Statistics and see it. You can see where the job breakdown, where the changes occur in this report that just came out. And it is that a major shift occurred from this, when we look at all previous employment patterns in since we've been keeping records on this, and this recovery, the percentage of the workforce in manufacturing is approaching a record low. The percentage of the workforce in healthcare leveled off a couple of years ago, but it's still up as a percentage of the workforce. It's like a record high, and it's just kind of stayed there. The good news is it's not still rising. The average, this is a really fascinating thing that came out of this, the average orthodontist makes more money than the average corporate CEO, which it's one of those little tidbits that I love right there, okay? Orthodontists earn more. Of course, now that CEOs can be CEOs of small companies, but I thought that was pretty interesting. Orthodontists should like that very much. The median, for those of you who think that you're going to get out there and make a lot of money in sports, and I realize our listeners are probably not in that group, the median pay for an athlete or sports competitor is $39,000, which is less than LeBron James gets per quarter of a basketball game.
Right.
One out of every 17 jobs in America is held by a retail salesperson or cashier. So there's a lot. That's if you want a job, that's the place
retail
to go.
Sales. There's lots of places there.
And anesthesiologists, if you really want high pay, put people to sleep, which means we should be really, really, really well paid.
Yeah, we put people to sleep all day long on Saturdays. And most days people are snoozing around us.
Anesthesiologists have an average salary of $235,000. Now, this is interesting. They earn more than surgeons. So the guy who has the mask over your face is earning more than the person with the knife in his hand, or her hand, as the case may be. I mean, it's just, we pay, the average non-farm animal caretaker is paid $22,500, which is more than that we pay child care workers.
Non-farm animal caretaker.
Yes.
What does that even mean?
I don't know.
Is that a veterinarian?
It's not a veterinarian. This is somebody who takes care of animals, like boarding.
And how much do they get paid?
$22,500 a year.
Okay. All right. That seems appropriate.
A child care worker gets $21,000. They're doing the same thing for children. They only get $21,500. Which means that we've crossed the line to where our animals...
It's a lot harder to take kids for a walk. You don't have as many leashes to go around, and, you know, it's so...
But the issue is that we pay people more to take care of animals while we're on vacation than we do daycare workers for our children.
Right.
I just thought that I'd throw some of these things in there. When the bureaucrats come up with some... You know, you have to be a geek
These are fascinating numbers.
To appreciate these numbers, but I just...
Is there anything about music industry? Because that, like the sports industry, people think, oh, you're going to sell a lot of records.
I'm looking at a summary right here, but I'll bet... Well, there is. I've got the whole report if you want to see it. It goes on many, 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 many pages.
Ah, yes, I want to look at that.
And it actually has every occupation listed by the Bureau of Labor Statistics and gives its average, you know, its mean income and all kinds of things.
Right.
It's actually, if you're as geeky as I am, it's a pretty fascinating. By the way, the average salary for an economist is the median average salary is $93,000, but the average salary is $101,000.
The median average is
no. The median and the average are different.
Okay.
And
right,
so it's $93,000
is the median.
Is their median, but their average is $101,000.
Okay,
and only an economist would understand that or care about it.
That makes sense.
The other thing is that the United States has 4.6 public relations specialists for every reporter.
Say that again.
The United States of America has 4.6 people working in public relations.
For every single reporter.
Every single newspaper, media reporter or correspondent.
It and takes they, four of them to keep the one 4. From.
4.6.
Yes.
And they earn 40% more a year than the journalists
do. It seems like there's a reason why so many journalists have been leaving journalism and going over to the corporate or political side of public relations.
This is all interesting stuff. By the way, you are listening to the Personal Wealth Coach, and our telephone number is in here, 773-1400 or
1-866-597-1400.
I know that I'm monopolizing this, but I got another...
Okay, go ahead.
I got another nitinoid here that is factoid, nitinoid. There's a report that was sponsored by the Federal Reserve, and their people worked on it, and they did a very, very careful study on something that has bothered me and us for quite a few years. Interest rates have been declining, as have inflation rates, since 1984. And interestingly enough, if we took the 3-month real Treasury rate, that is the actual interest being paid by the Treasury on a Treasury note, I mean a bill, minus the actual inflation over the time of the 90 days that the bill was outstanding before it matured, we discover that it has come from around 4% to a negative 1%, which is where it is now. It's been down as low as a negative 2 in the recent past. The question is, what the heck is going on? As our economy has recovered from what is commonly called the Great Recession, which technically was over in 2009 because the downside of it went over. We're not recovered yet, so I think we're still in the tail end of it. The interesting thing is that normally at this point, interest rates start to rise. If you recall, a year or two ago, the mere thought of the Federal Reserve withdrawing quantitative easing. And stopping buying so many bonds on the open market, there was a great fear interest rates and inflation were going to go up. Inflation across the world, across the Western world, Europe and the United States, remains near zero. Yes, food prices and to a lesser extent, fuel prices are bobbing around. For instance, the issue in Ukraine is causing worldwide food prices to rise because they produce a lot of food, and there's uncertainty there.
And but, their price of gas has doubled.
Right. Well, I mean, I'm talking about worldwide.
Right. Their price of gas has doubled, which caused their price of food to have to go up, which they produce a lot of food, and that causes food to grow up for everybody.
Right. It's a global economy. It's all in dollars, by the way, which is interesting, not rubles. But the fascinating thing to everybody concerned here who studies this, including the Federal Reserve, is that interest rates should have risen by now and haven't. The assumption that the Federal Reserve has worked under is that the 10-year Treasury note, which is the benchmark, will rise to between 4 and 6%. It hasn't risen. It has fallen a little bit in the time period when everybody thought it was going to rise. Now, the Federal Reserve study, and they wrote in the International Monetary Fund's World Economic Outlook, suggests that there has been a fundamental shift in the world economy. Now, will it stay this way forever? No. But that we may have low interest rates and low inflation for the foreseeable future. That this level of interest that we're seeing right now, this very, very low interest rate level at the banks or wherever you go, may very well be a stable position that will go on for decades.
Yeah. What causes this is kind of, this is the point that I can step in and kind of make some observations. A lot of people are paying off their debt everywhere. The people that are in, well, this is a great example. In we talk about this on the program on multiple other occasions, the great experiments that are going on in Europe, in North America, and in Asia for how to deal with economic crisis. We tried three different approaches. In Europe, they tried austerity. They cut the government budget. They cut the payrolls of people that were working for government. They cut the pensions of people that were retired and had basically the same as Social Security. And they prolonged the recession. The unemployment went sky high. In North America, we gave a stimulus, a bit of a tax cut, and then we started austerity. And by that, I mean that our budget is it's growing at a much slower rate than it was before.
A little interjection here on the jobs report. Uh-huh. The 192,000 additional jobs were all private sector.
Right.
The governmental job level, local and federal, stayed flat.
Yeah. If you look at the amount that was being spent on government and what is being spent on government now, it's less. That's what the whole sequester was about. We had less money going in there. If you look at the number of jobs for teachers, for police officers, at municipal government offices across the country, we've got less of them. So the job growth that we're seeing is in the private sector. It is still shrinking in the government sector. So those conservatives out there that want a smaller government, that's what we're seeing right now. And it is slowing the recovery. And then you have the third experiment is Asia. China just pumped the money into the economy during the entire recession. They've got some inflation. Coming back to long-term looking at low interest rates, in all three sets of economies, the individual, the consumer, has been working hard at lowering their own debt. When you're lowering your own debt and you want to have a safe place to put your money, you tend to do what's in other times during our history has been rather silly, which is give money to the government. And the United States government, again, warts and pimples all over it, but much better than the other governments as far as stability, has been releasing bonds still. We're still borrowing. We're borrowing less than we were. The reason why interest rates are as low as they are is because people are lining up. People are lining up to give the government money. Well, they don't have to raise the interest rate because they don't have to pay the money back to the people because people want to give them money for security. And that is why if this concept of keeping debt low and keeping savings high continues, then we will have long-term, a set of low interest rates.
There's some implications to this, though. It's one thing to say we're going to have low interest rates. This is true. It's really good if you're borrowing money. If you're going to borrow money to mortgage a house or something like that, you wind up paying. Right now, the mortgage interest rates in the United States, if we assume 3-point-something% interest rates and we look at a 2% inflation rate going forward, it's effectively zero. But that's not the key thing. Here's the thing that we probably ought to be a little bit concerned about. Well, actually, a lot. There are assumptions, interest rate assumptions, built into any organization's portfolio that promises to pay you money in the future. Now, what is a portfolio, an investment portfolio that promises to pay you money in the future? A pension plan and an insurance company. The bigger one is the insurance company, not the pension plan. Pension plans have the ability, in most cases, to adjust their holdings to put more equities in a low interest rate environment. A low interest rate environment, for instance, Texas Teachers Retirement Fund says whenever this is standard portfolio theory, we have a really, really low interest rate environment going forward. That will be good for business going forward. Therefore, we should be more oriented towards stable equities, stable companies that have, like we were talking about earlier, Microsoft, Intel, companies that have a lot of cash, have a good cash flow, pay a dividend, and will grow slowly into the future, but are very stable. Now, who can't do that? Highly regulated organizations like insurance companies, and I say highly, the states regulate them, are often locked into a position where they have to go, where they have to generate a certain percentage of their income, if you will, from bonds. Now, if interest rates stay low, let's just say interest rates are down 1% below where the actuaries at the insurance companies anticipated, and they promised you an interest rate into the future that was based on when you do all the calculations in an annuity or whatever you're doing, you wind up with a 4% assumption into the future. What if they only get 3? Now you've been thinking, well, so they get 3. Answer is, in order to pay out their promised payments, they'll go bankrupt.
Right.
And this is one of those esoteric little weird things. If in fact, and I don't know this is true, but the Federal Reserve is certainly looking at it being true, a distinct possibility that is true, that we have had a shift in our national economy to put it back where it was prior to the 1970s. See, prior to the 1970s, interest rates were traditionally very, very low. You effectively got 0% at the bank. You can go back further where you did get 0% at the bank when we had very, very little inflation. And the end result, if the end result of all of this is that we have low interest rates going into the future, it makes a profound difference in where you need to put your money, A. B, it makes a profound difference in the federal debt structure. If interest rates stay low, which they appear to be doing for a long period of time, the projected debt of the United States government is just a tiny fraction of what we think it is today. And in fact, Lawrence Summers just published a paper.
Yeah.
He coined a term called secular stagnation. And he says more deficit spending on the right things, like right now we're shorting infrastructure and bridges and things like that.
We actually need those things.
More deficit spending on things that produce long-term gains would actually produce more taxes than the interest would cost over the long term, and therefore the government ought to, for instance, in the highway bill, be willing to jump right in there and borrow all the money that is necessary to bring the infrastructure of the United States back up to full par instead of trimming it like they've done recently.
Right. If we use a scenario, say the government is a hotel and it makes its money by having the rooms full.
The California Hotel?
No. When you check in there.
Hotel America.
Hotel California. You know, if they don't put any of that money back towards upkeep of the elevators and the stairways, and making sure that the rooms are clean, nobody's going to stay at that hotel. And that's the truth about infrastructure. We have to have infrastructure. It does not give I mean, just like a hotel, if you're getting $1,000 a night for a room, it's a really nice room, and you spend $10,000 on that room, you can't raise the price of that room up to $2,000 a night. Nobody's going to stay there. You spend that $10,000 just to keep the rate where it is. We have to do upkeep if we have bridges that are failing.
And we need to actually widen those bridges. We don't need to just fix them.
Right. And in the case of, here's a great example of railroads. We're getting close back close to the capacity of the railroad system again. If our economy is going to expand, if we're going to export, if we're going to import, if we're going to move things around the country, the most efficient form of moving right now is railroad. Has been for about 200 years. Mm-hmm. When we move that stuff around and we can't fit enough stuff on the railroad, well, then we have to use a less efficient form, trucks. You start using trucks and the roads get filled with these trucks that are moving around so that we can make ARCA, and there's a problem there.
I think they are.
The roads are already full of trucks. If we get more trucks on the road, it has a problem that the underlying road itself starts to fail because it's not designed to have that many trucks on it. It's designed to have a lot more cars on it. It also makes it so that you and I, when trying to get to our business, are stuck behind all these trucks, and it slows down the economy all across the board. So infrastructure has no direct benefit to the economy. It's the indirect benefit. The thing is Ronald Reagan would say, the trickle down. That's where you start. If you build an infrastructure that's going to allow us to continue to grow, then we will see, and there's another aspect of that, education. We have to look at education and how the money is being spent in education. There's a lot of better things that we can be doing as a government there as well. And we've got some commercials to play.
Right. By the way, just to tail in on this thing, at the speech in the papers and so on that were released last week suggested that borrowing more money right now at these very, very low interest rates by the government and using it and investing it in productive issues over the long term, such as infrastructure, would result in a lower GDP to debt ratio, or debt to GDP ratio, rather, 10 years from now than austerity would. Austerity, cutting spending today, will increase our debt in 10 years because we will have lower tax revenues because our highways are jammed, in essence.
Right.
It makes tremendous sense. And by the way, the other thing about the low interest rates, Chinese apparently have discovered savings.
Right.
And they are saving hand over fist, which former Chairman Ben Bernanke described as the global savings glut.
Which is part of the reason why the interest rates are staying low everywhere.
Yeah. Anyway, we're going to do some commercials, and we'll be back after these words from Town Square's sponsors. And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And people are going up and down the hallway yelling and laughing, which means somewhere in a radio station there's someone having entirely too much
right.
fun.
They're not allowed to have fun in radio.
Right, exactly. Well, this is the Personal Wealth Coach, and if you'd like to give us a call in here on this Saturday, April 5th, 773-1400 is the telephone number in East Bell County. Otherwise,
1-866-597-1400 anywhere else.
There's one other issue with low interest rates that you should be aware of if presuming you're investing, and that is that anyone who is offering an interest rate above that over the long term of a 10-year treasury note is exposing you to significant risk. I want to say that again. Any organization, any company that's a for-profit organization, like an insurance company or anything else, whether it be a real estate deal or a whatever that you might want to get into, that offers you an interest rate particularly if they use the terrible word guarantee or promise, that is higher than a 10-year treasury note interest rate if you bought it that day, exposes you to significant risk. Not a little risk.
Significant.
And the reason I say that is the company is going to try to make a profit.
Oh, and so this is not scandalous. We live in a capitalistic society. We want people to make profits.
Right. So if a treasury note is paying 2.75%, if you bought it today, and over the next 10 years and you get your money back and there's 2.75% interest, which is probably, if inflation is 2.75, you get nothing back because there's no risk. You get a zero return in effect. And a company comes to you and says, we'll pay you 4%. And they probably are going to make at least a 1% profit on that during the year. So that's what they're saying is we can get 5 with no risk. What they've done is they've effectively doubled the treasury return, the zero risk return, which implies they have produced a great deal of risk. Well, you say, and this is the common thing when I talk to people about this, well, wait a minute, they promise and there was no fluctuation in value and, excuse me, this thing where they're promising you this return typically will have like a 7-year period that if you get out of it, they'll charge you a whole bunch of money so you'll lose money. The second thing they will generally say is there may or may not be a market for this if you decide you want to get out of it and put money in your pocket, so the money is only there if you don't take it. And third, in many cases, and man, have you got to read the fine print on this, we promise you this minimum return at this point, but if you take the money at the maturity date, the money won't be there. Literally, I have seen this in insurance annuity contracts. We promise you a certain return. You will have at least this value on this date. But in the fine print, it says only if you annuitize it with us and leave it with us and let it be our property. If you take the money out,
you have less than that.
You lose money. Anyway, Jake.
All right. I'm going to have a shift in conversation subject here. We're changing the subject. Please brace yourselves. I spoke earlier about disgust and about how blueberries and cockroaches. Well, I'm going to explain something else that has just been discovered.
At least been proven. Discover and disgust sound alike?
Very, very, very much so, yes. I guess
you uncovered the cockroaches.
I would rather stay gusted than be disgusted.
Okay, yes.
If covered and discovered are the same. Covered and discovered.
Yeah. Anyway,
Thomas Jefferson wrote about how a two-party system has basically been in place for millennia. Even places where they have multiple parties, they can be broken into conservative and liberal. And this goes back as long as time. And that it really represents more differences in people's brains, in the personalities of people, than it does in true political differences. And it's only recently been discovered that he was absolutely right. That you can put people into a brain scanner, a functional MRI, and watch how they react to disgusting things and tell with a great deal of accuracy whether they're conservative or liberal. The amount of disgust that you feel when a subject arises has a lot to do with whether or not you become a conservative or a liberal in your life, and that changes throughout your life. People that are concerned with keeping what they have rather than growing what they have get to be very, very sensitive to disgusting things because they want to stay away from it. And you say the word gay marriage, those words together, and you measure somebody's skin electrical signal, the stress levels, how much sweat they have. You look at the functional MRI of what reactions in their brain. And disgust, when it comes to cockroaches and when it comes to gay marriage and when it comes to a lot of other things, are things that arise from a defense of yourself. And I find it quite interesting because this applies directly to how we invest. When people have gotten to a point where they are conserving their income, they're looking at the value of their portfolio and they're saying, I want to keep this. They act very differently than people that are beginning their investment process and they're looking ahead and they're saying, I need to take risks in order to get where I'm going. It's the same reaction in our brains as we have to liberal and conservative. And most conservatives tend to be older. It isn't that the conservatives are all dying out. It's that when people get older, they tend to be more conservative. They are more interested in preserving what they already have and preserving for the future what will be. And as they're younger, they are willing to take risks and do things that might expand. And if you look at our system, then I've actually got a path that I'm coming to, a point that I'm trying to make here. We need both liberals and conservatives. Because if you look back at what the United States was in the 1950s, it was a pretty insular society that was extremely segregated. It was, while we were growing faster than the rest of the world, we didn't have the kind of advances that needed to be made that we did to work together to advance. We needed the liberal movement and we needed the conservative movement. The conservative movement says, we're not going to move backwards. You're not going to take what we have. And the liberal movement says, we want more. Without both of those things together, we don't advance. We will stagnate. Or we will advance too fast and we will collapse. So when we look at a new governmental system as it springs up and then collapses, that happens so often if you look at Afghanistan. It's because if you think about what Afghanistan is, the Taliban is the conservative movement. The new government is the liberal movement. If the new government doesn't get some conservatives involved, they will expand too fast and collapse. But if it only has conservatives, that's what the Taliban was there, their version of conservatism, then you never move beyond the 1100 AD time frame. Liberalism and conservatism can be measured in our brains. It can be measured in our actions. And recognizing the strengths behind liberalism is important to conservatism. And recognizing the strength in conservatism is important to liberals. If we don't have both of those, we don't move forward. And I'm not saying that you should make friends with your political opponents. I am only saying that you should respect them because there is a reason for it. And it's as rational as the reasons that you hold. There you go.
All right. And you are listening to the Personal Wealth Coach. We've got about 6 minutes left in the hour, the second hour here on Saturday, April 5th. Telephone numbers in here are 773-1400 or
1-866-597-1400.
I have one other little item that was brought to my attention this week again, although it comes up very regularly. If you're listening today and you have an IRA, a 401k, a 403b, a 457, a 401a, or any other retirement plan.
Letter number combination.
Or an insurance policy or contract or annuity policy or contract. Any of these items. The distribution of the value at your death from those items is not controlled by your last will and testament. Now, why did I say that so distinctly? Because I read a survey this morning that indicated that the very, very large majority of Americans who have those programs believe that if they put in, for example, in their will, all of my worldly possessions and will be distributed equally to my children.
And they still have a beneficiary right on their IRA that says something else.
Yes, and their ex-wife is still the beneficiary on their 401k. Guess what? The ex-wife gets all of the money in the 401k. State of Texas, for example, for will not allow, and I'm not an attorney here, it's just my understanding, that will not allow a man to disinherit his wife or a spouse. You can't. You have to leave them something.
Unless they sign off on it.
Right.
They have to sign. The spouse has to sign off on that.
But you can't just arbitrarily disinherit your spouse. However, if the majority of your wealth is in a 401k and you haven't changed the beneficiary designation on your 401k from your previous wife, you just left everything to your previous wife and disinherited your wife. And it's perfectly legal because that is covered, a 401k is covered under federal law. And the way that it's a contract, and it constitutes a debt owed to somebody else. And it's because all of your retirement, all of your tax deferrals, your insurance policies, these are all contracts. And contracts get paid first, then whatever's left over gets handled by your will. And if when you have on a 401k, a 403b, or an IRA, or an annuity, or a life insurance policy, a beneficiary named, that is a contractual obligation to that beneficiary, and it gets paid first.
It doesn't necessarily pass through the same court system.
Right.
It just goes straight out to that person.
Actually, it doesn't pass through a court system. It just goes, and it's over there. Now, this is the point.
And that's the technical term for how it moves. It goes,
yeah. That's that fast. It doesn't even, you've just avoided probate. Congratulations.
Yes.
This is the point. Who are your beneficiaries? Who are your contingent beneficiaries? If you don't know,
you should
look, because it's one of the things we're going through with our clients right now is reviewing everything they have, including the things that we don't necessarily look at day to day, the things we're not necessarily managing, but we want them to review their estate plan, and they're not necessarily make a new will or anything else, but simply look and see, is everything lined up? And I can't, when people come in, it's exceptional that they realize that their beneficiary designations at the company where they work trump the will.
And this is interesting. It's often the case with attorneys that don't do wills regularly that they don't know it.
And they don't even ask the question.
And that's important. So there are things that you should know about your will. There are things that attorneys should know about putting a will together that have to do with exactly this. If you've got a beneficiary on a bank account, if it says it's a transfer on death account, then it doesn't go through the will. Your will might say this goes to somebody else. It's too late. It's already gone to the person that said transfer on death on the account.
Yeah, what really set me off on this was reading an article about a case where a man got married, had been married 2 months when he died. He thought he was leaving everything to his children and not his new wife, but in fact,
he left everything to his ex-wife.
No, he left it to his. He left his entire 401k, which had and 457 and everything that had millions and millions of dollars in it to it to his brand new wife. Because what it said on there, this should be transferred to my wife.
Oh, that'll do it.
That's all he wrote on there, and he didn't change it to his children later on. Now, he didn't write the name. He said to my wife.
Right.
And when he got married again, 2 months later, he's dead, and his children were disinherited. You are listening to The Personal Wealth Coach, and if you would like to contact us off the air during the week, of course, we have real, live, very pleasant human beings who answer the telephone. But on weekends, we have a voicemail, and you can give us a call and leave a message on that voicemail at 947-1111 locally, or
you can also reach us toll-free at 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. Again, that's voicemail. Or you can reach us by email at jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com, or you can go to our webpage, where we have podcasts and we have newsletters. We have all kinds of things, pictures of us, which I would recommend caution in approaching that area. But that is thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com. And it's been a pleasure talking to you this week.
We look forward to speaking to you again next week. This has been The Personal Wealth Coach.
Your Fox News station in Central Texas. News Radio 1400 KTEM AM. Temple, Belton, Killeen, Fort Hood.